703, report on recent work from the city auditor, Portland Parks Golf, fixing our streets program, Portland building follow-up, and housing bond.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I am City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero, and we are here to present results from our most recent four audits. And I'm going to jump right in, since we have a lot to present today with introductions of my staff who are going to do the honors of the presentations. First, Audit Services Director Kari Guy is going to present the Portland Parks Golf Audit on behalf of Bob McKay, who led the audit team. Jennifer Scott will discuss fixing our streets. And then after those two presentations, Tenzin Gonta will come up, and she will talk about the Portland building audit, and Martha Prince will report on the housing bond audit. Before we begin, I want to mention that we also published an audit about the cannabis tax revenue, which I presented at the budget work session, and we're going to have a related audit on cannabis regulation in the fall. And you can also look forward to another audit of the Portland building, which focuses on cost compliance and change orders. We contracted with construction experts for that work. And one final note, Mayor, I'd like to remind you that no council action is necessary at the end of our presentation. We are here strictly for information sharing purposes. So let's begin with the golf audit.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Again, I'm Kari Guy. We produced this audit in May of this year. Portland Parks and Rec golf program is intended to be self-supporting. However, in 2017, it required an $800,000 infusion from the general fund to remain solvent. Golf has been in decline both locally and nationally for a number of years. In the 5 years of our audit, the golf rounds at city courses were down about 6%, and over 25 years, they're down 46%. We audited the program to see if it is now positioned to be financially stable and if the program is managed effectively. For background, the city owns five courses, four on the east side of the Willamette and one in Beaverton. In general, city staff maintain the courses in most clubhouses, while daily operations are managed by private operators under contract with the city. But the city's involvement in each of the five courses varies. Currently, there are five unique contracts, four different operators, and three different agreement types, each with different terms. This complexity creates challenges for oversight. There are many variables that influence the success of the golf program, some within parks' control, like the fees, and some completely out of their control, like the weather. After the general fund transfer in 2017, Portland Parks Golf improved practices to address some of these variables. They reduced maintenance costs by cutting positions and sharing maintenance staff and equipment across courses. They also hired a new director, and they put a lot of effort into increasing outreach to more diverse communities to recruit new players to the game. But Parks hasn't yet addressed some of the other variables that affect success, such as the deferred maintenance at the courses. The result is that financial risks remain. Some courses are doing better than others. Three of the courses had positive cash flow in all of the 5 years we reviewed. But the negative cash flow at some courses, combined with the golf program's administrative overhead costs of about $1 million per year, meant the program had an overall negative income in three of the 5 years that we looked at. In addition, the newest course, Colwood, which was purchased in 2014 with a loan from the Parks Capital Improvement Fund, the debt repayment will continue to impact the golf fund for four more years. So financially, this leaves the program with a very tight margin. In a good weather year, if the recruiting new players is successful, they will have a positive balance. And in fact, Parks reports that in fiscal year 19, after our audit was completed, they did end in the black. But another rainy year and slow recruitment of new golfers may leave the fund again in trouble without further action by council. We also looked at Portland Parks' administration of the operator contracts. As I mentioned earlier, there are five different agreements, including one lease, two concession agreements, and two management agreements. We found lax contract management, relying more on trust and relationships with the operators. For example, some contract provisions were not followed, such as not asking for required marketing plans or not conducting the performance reviews. And although the contracts require parks to perform routine maintenance, deferred maintenance has been mounting for most facilities. Finally, the five courses were not identified as part of the larger parks program. So a visitor to these courses doesn't necessarily know they're part of Portland Parks. The only indication they were part of a city system that our auditors saw when they were on site were no smoking signs. Parks has now aligned the East Side contracts to end at the same time and is planning on soliciting bids to operate under a more streamlined system. This move provides an opportunity to address some of these issues that we identified in the audit. We had two main recommendations. First, that Parks develop alternative financial forecast scenarios and present them to City Council for direction on how to proceed, and including in those forecasts a way to address deferred maintenance and some of the other issues in the audit. And second, that as they renegotiate contracts, they reflect current program conditions and increase the monitoring of contract provisions to ensure that contract provisions are followed.
Mayor?
Commissioner Fish.
Because you said they're going to be rotating out auditors, Madam Auditor, is it okay if I just make a comment now?
Please.
First of all, I have been the commissioner in charge since last September, and obviously the Parks Bureau welcomes this audit. We have, in the letter that's attached to the audit, we have embraced the recommendations, and we thank you for them. You were exactly right in what you said earlier about the one of the key variables for us, which is the weather. And who can predict that? But as you said, it turns out that in 2018, 2019, we had decent weather. We're having great weather now, and frankly, I think it's gonna have a significant impact on revenues. But to the points that you made, I just wanna say to the new leadership team that was put in place before I took over at Golf, in the last fiscal year, they made over $500,000 in net revenue, so that's at least a positive sign, again, reflecting good weather and good management. We have in our reserves now $1 million, and you've pointed out that those reserves are vulnerable to some of the costs that we have, but we're pleased that we've got the reserves up to $1 million, and we intend to set a more ambitious goal. We'll be looking at a sustainable path forward, and the next milestone for us will be coming to Council in November to talk to Council about options for putting Parks on a more solid financial footing going forward. Now, while we're looking at it enterprise-wide, it's going to be fair to ask, how does that impact some of our enterprise businesses like Golf? So to the auditor and her team, thank you for a thoughtful audit. It raised a number of issues that we're tackling as we speak, and I spend every night saying an extra prayer that we have decent weather. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Hi, my name is Jenny Scott, and I led the audit of the Fixing Our Streets program. We released our audit report called Fixing Our Streets, Some Accountability Commitments Not Fulfilled in May. Portland voters approved a temporary gas tax in May 2016 to fund a Bureau of Transportation program called Fixing Our Streets. Council passed a separate tax on heavy vehicles to help ensure that all vehicle owners fund the program. 2 years into the program, we assessed how the city is delivering on these Fixing Our Streets accountability and program commitments. I'm going to walk through our findings related to each one of these commitments. We assessed whether 45 gas tax funded projects and 14 heavy vehicles tax funded projects were completed on schedule and within budget. Of the 59 projects we examined, 38 were scheduled to start before 2019. We found that only 12 projects had started before 2019, and 8 were completed before 2019. Bureau staff said the schedules, which were developed after the gas tax was approved, were not realistic and that it took longer than anticipated to break ground because the scopes of individual projects were not well defined. Of the 8 projects that were completed before 2019, 4 were on budget. 2 were over budget and 2 were under budget. Overall, these projects were $900,000 or 15% over the budgets communicated to voters. Bureau staff said that the budgets were only estimates subject to change. Council adopted the heavy vehicle use tax to help ensure that heavy vehicle owners pay their fair share of the program since they do not pay the gas tax. We found that heavy vehicle owners did not pay into the program commensurate with what experts calculated was their share of city street maintenance, operations, and improvement costs. Council required that the tax paid by owners of heavy vehicles generate $10 million over 4 years, and code required that the tax rate be adjusted if it generated more or less than $2.5 million in its first or second year of collection. During the first year of the tax, heavy vehicle owners paid $1.8 million, well below the $2.5 million goal. However, council eliminated the requirement that the rate be adjusted to meet the revenue goal, citing concerns from the Freight and Fixing Our Streets Oversight Committees. The Fixing Our Streets Program's Oversight Committee is comprised of volunteers who meet quarterly. The Bureau provided the committee with volumes of information. However, we found that the committee could not effectively fulfill its monitoring role because the project lists and financial reports the Bureau provided them were incomplete, inconsistent, and outdated. We also found that the committee did not fulfill their reporting requirements. City Council made three commitments regarding audits, each suggesting a different type of review and focus. We found that the Bureau was not inviting the oversight, transparency, and accountability that Council's commitments implied because it was not obtaining annual program audits or sharing results. The City committed to maintain a precise expenditure split between street repair and safety projects. It was difficult to determine if the Bureau had maintained the spending split it promised. A project list available to voters didn't indicate that street repair projects may include safety elements, and a plan to prioritize Americans with Disabilities Act curb ramps was classified as a safety project. The Bureau included new curb ramps in the budgets of all of the Fixing Our Streets paving projects, with the exception of base repair. On the other hand, when safety projects needed paving done, that work was not included in the Fixing Our Streets safety project budget. For one project in our sample, the paving work was funded from the Fixing Our Streets street repair budget. And for the other safety project, the paving work was paid for with funds from outside of the Fixing Our Streets program. Since the gas tax measure included a commitment that future funds be allocated 56% to street repair and 44% to safety, the Bureau needs to clarify what constitutes a street repair project versus a safety project and how those funds are accounted for. To ensure that monitoring and oversight of the Fixing Our Streets program is effective, the Bureau of Transportation should provide the Fixing Our Streets Oversight Committee with information needed to understand and carry out its responsibility. To meet public expectations, the Bureau of Transportation should track and publicly report on Fixing Our Streets projects as they relate to public commitments, explore opportunities to ensure that heavy vehicle owners pay their share of the program, specify the type of audit desired and ensure that audit commitments are fulfilled and reported, and make ballot commitments that are clear, realistic, measurable, achievable, and time-bound. To ensure that funds are tracked and spent according to commitments made to voters, the Bureau of Transportation, with the input of the Oversight Committee and Council, should clarify language regarding the split of funding for street repair and safety projects, and informed by the clarification, the Bureau should track and account for spending to ensure that the split of funding for street repair and safety projects is maintained. Thank you.
Mayor. Commissioner Daly.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you. I always look forward to these audits, and if the public's interested, you can read our responses at the end of this report. I'm pleased to say that we agree with all the issues that you highlighted and that we either were already making progress on them by the time the audit was completed, or we have now begun. So I always appreciate the feedback from the auditor's office, and but I do want to add that I'm really proud of the work that the Bureau has done, and note that we are on track to finish 20 projects this year and break ground on an additional 21. And so I think our one-year review is going to be a glowing report. At least that's my goal. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Can I just use this opportunity to thank you for something?
Certainly.
I don't know whether, has the auditor, have you done an audit of Vision Zero?
No, that was one of the options we considered, but we focused
you.
On fixing
it. not specific, but, yeah. But well, I just wanted to say that we reached out to Commissioner Daly's office recently and said we'd like to go out into the field and see high crash corridors and for ourselves, and I'm sure you as auditors like to get out in the field and actually see the work. And so we had an all-star team that spent a morning with us showing us high crash corridors and intersections. And our head was spinning with all the information we got, but there's nothing like seeing it firsthand and also to see the remarkable investment that the city's making throughout the city. So we learned a lot, and we're really appreciative of the extra mile that PBOT went to give us a front row seat on what's happening. And I tell you, my takeaway is that I'm even more committed to finding the dollars to help you meet the mission goals of Vision Zero.
Thank you.
So we're ready to move on to the Portland building audit.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Tenzin Gonta, and I served as the lead auditor for the Portland building audit. Our June report is titled Greater Transparency Needed About Project Costs, Trade-offs, and Missed Equity Requirement. The Portland building is an active construction site, and the renovation is forecasted to be completed ahead of schedule. Our first audit of the renovation covered the planning phase and ended in July 2016 after the city's selection of its construction contractor. At that point, crucial decisions remained during the design phase, most notably about the project's defined scope. This second audit follows up on the three areas we identified that the city should closely manage for the Portland building renovation to be a success. Our follow-up fieldwork period ended in December 2018. Unfortunately, the city did not fully implement those early recommendations. While the opportunity to revisit decisions has passed, we make new recommendations for the remainder of the project. We'll now go into each of the three follow-up areas that align with these 2016 recommendations: project costs, trade-offs, and equity grants. The first follow-up area focused on project costs. We found that the budget transparency is still needed for the collective costs associated with the Portland building. The public narrative about the Portland building is focused on activities tied to the $195 million budget. This is the budget shared with Council and the Oversight Committee and posted on the city website. However, this public narrative does not include all the components critical to delivering a functional building. As of December 2018, projected costs for the Portland building grew to $214 million once these side projects were included. Here's an example of a side project. When the project scope began to be defined in December 2016, the $195 million budget excluded the build-out of 2.5 office floors in the building. Later in March 2017, the project team requested to finish these 2.5 floors, and Council approved the additional $7 million. These collective Portland building costs are important because they will be allocated to tenant bureaus and ultimately will have a long-term effect on the city's capacity for direct services to residents. The city's downtown tenant rates will go up by 102% between fiscal year 2019 and fiscal year 2021. And this is primarily driven by the Portland building's collective costs. About one quarter of these increased costs will be borne by the general fund, with development services, transportation, and utility funds responsible for most of the remainder. Over the years, the project team has been transparent with Council about each individual budget request, but there's been no presentation of the collective costs that result from these piecemeal decisions. Given the significance of the side project activity, we recommend the collective Portland building costs be described when presenting budget to actual reports to Council and the Oversight Committee. The second follow-up area is about trade-off decisions. The project team committed to minimum requirements and also introduced the opportunity to pursue additional goals and aspirations, as shown in this image from their July 2016 presentation to Council. We found the city is on track to meet minimum requirements, for example, the requirement to eliminate water intrusion. However, the city did not report on trade-offs that affected other opportunities to reach beyond the project's minimum requirements. The city will fall short of the goals and aspirations stated in the project charter in the areas of accessibility, sustainability, and historic preservation. For accessibility, the city anticipates some previously inventoried barriers will remain in parts of the building not included in the renovation, such as stairway and elevator areas. For sustainability, the building is on track to achieve LEED Gold certification, but the city pursued exemptions for three other policy requirements, and we found no evidence that the project met another two policy requirements. For historic preservation, the city chose an exterior design to address the building's water leaks, which will result in the building's delisting from the National Register of Historic Places. There are still compliance actions for the city to take. We make specific recommendations related to the Americans with Disabilities Act and historic preservations at the state and local level. Our third and last follow-up area examined the Portland Building Equity Grants. In 2016, Council set aside $1 million of the renovation budget for community benefits to address historical inequities in construction and improve diversity in the workforce and among subcontractors. Council also required that community benefits, quote, be dispersed in phases through the life of the Portland Building Project, and the Chief Administrative Officer will report back regularly to the Council on activities and results, end quote. We found the city missed these equity requirements for the Portland building. As of December 2018, there has been no report to Council about the status of these activities or results. We found no community grants were made to support disadvantaged workers and businesses, and the city had no plan to ensure the money would be dispersed by the time the building is complete. Given the unspent funds, it is unclear how about $360,000 from water and sewer ratepayers will remain accountable to these restricted sources. Lastly, with less than 1 year of construction remaining, the city missed a strategic opportunity to use community benefits funding to help meet its stated equity goals for the Portland building. Given the challenges that remain with the Portland Building's community benefits, we recommend that the Chief Administrative Officer report to Council as required by the original resolution and inform 2018 applicants of the city's grant-making status, and remove ratepayer funds from the community benefits budget if future grants are not reasonably related to the provision of water and sewer services. That concludes our presentation of this audit report. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I have a number of comments, and I feel like I've already made most of my comments, both in terms of defending the work of the city and validating the information that the Community Oversight Committee has already provided, which disagrees with many of the findings in this audit. So I don't want to go in that direction today. What I want to do is talk about what I think is a fundamental disconnect in the way we are evaluating large-scale capital construction projects. Because as you read the audit and then you read the responses to the audit, it's very clear we have a disconnect. Mm-hmm. There is not agreement, for example, on what the original scope of the project is. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who has come in, and the Chief Administrative Officer who came in after this project was already scoped and underway, I find that somewhat remarkable that there wasn't a meeting of the minds, including the audit team, the auditor, to clearly define what the scope of the project is. And so the response has been that the audit says that the project team did not begin, quote, excluding some elements from the project, or did begin excluding some elements from the project scope to stay within its $195 million proposed budget. But the response, both from the CAO as well as the Community Oversight Committee, which is composed of experienced developers, says that furnishings, technology, equipment, and childcare build-out were never part of the project scope. What happened, in fact, was additional packages were brought to the City Council for approval, and they could either vote it up, which would increase the cost of the project, or they could vote it down. One project that was brought to the City Council that was approved, for example, is the space optimization project. And this was an attempt. There is a cost to the space optimization project. It brings more people into the building. It lowers out year costs by about $25 million over the next 20 years by bringing more people in so we don't have more leases outside of the project. My concern, if the standard by which we are judging projects in the future is you said it was going to be X. In this case, X is $195 million. Mm-hmm. But if somebody brings new ideas to the council, for example, technology could be implemented better, space could be utilized more efficiently, and these things could save the city ongoing operating costs, getting to the first sentence that you mentioned about how the capital construction piece potentially limits other resources for other city mm-hmm. services. If the council votes for things like space optimization mm-hmm. or technology that in fact give us an even greater opportunity mm-hmm. to save out year funding, I'm afraid that the council will choose to not vote for those things, nor will those things come to the council, because people know that that will by definition make the project over budget. And the Project Oversight Committee took a good hard look at that question, and they said, no, these things should not be part of the baseline by which you are judging this project to be either on, you know, on budget or off budget. Mm-hmm. We can have an honest disagreement about that, but I think going forward, we need to have that conversation about whether or not these things are going to be considered included in that original estimate or not, because that's the difference between us being either on budget or not being on budget. And so I just think there's sort of a leadership question there, maybe more than an accountability question. By the way, the space optimization issue, it's my understanding that that will be covered by the contingency that remains in the budget. You had made a recommendation that we post additional budget information on the project website. It's my understanding, Tom, has that been done? And that is continuing to be done. I thought that was a great recommendation, so that information is available. Regarding the equity issue, the way it is being presented is as though we have completely blown it off, and that could not be farther from the truth. The COEP dollars that your team identified, which is, I believe, more than $800,000, that's going to be released once the COEP is established in Prosper Portland through the direction of the City Council. In short, the opportunity, though delayed, will in fact be realized as part of this project. And last but not least, I'm not sure we have clarity on what the role of the Citizen Oversight Committee actually is. I personally have viewed that, and I believe, I won't speak for the Chief Administrative Officer, but I believe he has viewed that as highly experienced, knowledgeable citizen eyes looking at everything. And their response, I'll just read a piece of this, is that that committee says, this letter is to underscore that in our view, the city staff have been very transparent with our committee on every aspect of the project, including granular matters concerning the budget, the scope, changes, and timing. There have been a number of difficult decisions relating to the building, and they've been shared with us. And to our knowledge, none of these have been contrary to the recommendations that we have made. And then they go on to talk about some of the other issues. So I have a tremendous amount of respect for Madam Auditor and for the auditing team. I think you can look back on my history as an elected official. You will see I have a tremendous amount of respect for the audit function, and I value the audit function as a way to sharpen, to improve, and to call attention to really important issues. But on this one, I and the Chief Administrative Officer and the Citizen Oversight Committee, we have fundamental disagreements, and it's my estimation that those disagreements should have been resolved at the beginning of the project. We should have agreed, what are we going to be judged on? What are we in agreement on in terms of the budget and the costs? And what is going to be expected in terms of the council's participation and inclusion in these matters? And I look forward to working with you, because I know you have a number of ideas and suggestions, as do I. So that's just sort of my commentary for today.
Mayor, if I could speak broadly,
you bet.
Not to the specifics of what you're saying, but our process starts with the documentation. So I was here when there were lots of discussions about that $195 million. I'm also aware that people were uncomfortable with such a hard and fast $195 million, not one penny more. I do think that's a dangerous way to approach a capital project. I think now we're at the point where we've borrowed $214 million, and that doesn't include the debt service on that borrowing. And so we have tracked back to the beginning of this project to where we are now. And so I appreciate what you're saying, that maybe it wasn't as organized at the beginning as it should be, and that's some of the things that we're pointing out, is that there were representations made to the public, and I am not sure that the public understood that they were going to get a $214 million bill for this building. And so what we've done is, in from the beginning of that to where we are now, looked at some of the things that we led us to where we got to $214 million. And in the original report, there were recommendations made saying, hey, you should pay attention to these areas, and there was some lack of clarity around the oversight committee and what their role was and who they were reporting to. And so we've just come back around with the second audit with some new recommendations from that point of view.
Great, and I look forward to that. Commissioner Fish?
It's a good conversation, and so it seems to me there were four people that were actually here at that time. This is part of the challenge of our former government with people coming and going. You were the auditor. Commissioner Saltzman was sitting next to me, and he was the author of that line, not a penny more than 195. How many times we heard that?
Yes.
That was his mantra. And then Commissioner Fritz was here. The thing I've struggled with a little bit in terms of the cost issue is that I remember cost coming up in the context of us looking at the alternatives to the Portland building. So we put together a blue ribbon group. They came back and looked at demolishing the building, renovating the building, selling the building, looking for another building, leasing. I think they looked at a range of choices. I think we were all somewhat surprised when they came back and said, renovating this building is the low-cost option. That was not intuitively what I thought was where it was going to land. But an independent panel came back and said, your most effective use of taxpayer dollars is to renovate what you have for a variety of reasons. I have to go back and look at the conversation, but I'll be honest with you. My recollection is when Commissioner Saltzman used to say not a penny over 195, it was his way of saying, don't come back and say we're going to have a new siding, or don't put in a new dining room, or don't come in with some new bell and whistle. My own view, and again, my memory isn't as good as it used to be, so I'll have to go back and look at the record, is that things like desks and equipment and how we organize the space and technology was going to be a cost no matter where we went. And I did not at the time assume that was within the 195. I'll just tell you, as someone who voted on it, and partly because I didn't think those were costs we had quantified. And in fact, we were still doing all this work with staff about how we were going to configure the space and how many people could we fit and other things. So I may be wrong. I'm going to go back because Dan was the most vocal in terms of the hard cap. But just my recollection is that the costs that you've identified in your report that are above the line, above 195, my recollection is those were not costs that we considered as part of the 195. Maybe I'm wrong, but at least when I cast the vote, I thought we were talking about hard construction costs, not the soft costs of filling the building. So,
can I speak to that?
Yeah.
So I wanted to go back to our original audit report, because if you remember, and this is, again, years ago, There was an original estimate of $95 million back in 2014, and then that went up to $175 million to reflect the additional scopes of work. So it wasn't just going to be the envelope fix that they were to address the water intrusion. That's when the seismic upgrades, as well as some of the interior improvements, were reflected in that cost. And then when it came to our audit report, we were looking at the 195, and we couldn't see the delta, the $20 million difference between what was in the supported estimates of $175 million and then the $195 million. So at that point, the project team at that time, under the previous chief administrative officer, gave us more detailed line item information. And if you look in our audit report, there's actually a line item for furniture, fixtures, and equipment of $10 million. So to me,
in the 195?
In the 195 that they provided to us. So part of the challenge is then
this CAO.
No, the previous CAO. Yeah, this is all before December of 2016.
Okay.
So when we're tracing that information, moving it forward to try and see what that $195 million activity, how that's reflected in current approaches to the renovation, that's where we see the disconnect.
So
that's just one example.
So I think what so to get back to what the auditor said and what the mayor alluded to, lesson for me in this is to be even more rigorous in terms of identifying the hard costs and the soft costs.
Mm-hmm.
When we say the hard construction costs, we're talking about, you know, maybe having, my understanding is that if you start bumping up against hard construction costs, you can always do some value engineering to come below. If, let's say, your costs of materials go above what you expect and other things. I think we have to be clear as a council in distinguishing that from soft costs, because the soft costs could change all the time based on, let's say, changes in technology or changes in how we want to configure the workplace. And I believe they are separate and distinct. So I think you've raised the question that we can address more rigorously in the future about being clear. So I appreciate your point.
And I think just to add, I think this build, and we haven't done a lot of construction, capital construction audits, but I think this project is a little bit different, that the scope was meant to be flexible because of the fixed time and budget elements. So if you think about the project management triangle, there's three different elements, and one is going to be the one that moves if there's any kind of pressure on the other two. So I don't know if the project definition issue is going to be something you would see in other capital activity here at the city.
Yeah, that's fair enough, and I appreciate that. And this is a really good conversation, and I guess if I had to boil it down into one sentence, it would be how do we set the original objective, be transparent about the objective, but also have the opportunity, if we see opportunities through technology configuration or whatever, to be able to reduce ongoing operating costs on a permanent basis or even for a number of many years. I want this council to feel the ability to take that option. And I don't want the council to feel that they would be penalized for having found a way to reduce costs over the long term. But for me, the big lesson in all of this is I don't think we agreed on the standard up front. And so this is, for me, a really good learning opportunity going forward. And I stipulate all the things you say about transparency and putting budget data online. I know a ton of people don't look at it, but it should be available there. I concur with you 100% on that, because there are some people who will take a good hard look at it. So I appreciate your work on this. Thank you.
And we're going to wrap up with the housing bond audit, which has some very good news in it.
Good morning. My name is Martha Prince. I'm a performance auditor for the city, and I completed our June 2019 audit of the city's housing bond. We took on this audit to check on the housing bond relatively early in the life of the bond, a little less than halfway through the life of the bond. And just for some background, Portland voters approved the $258 million housing bond in November 2016. Our audit looked at whether the Housing Bureau established and was applying clear criteria for project selection to ensure bond goals would be met. We also looked at whether the Bureau had systems in place to make sure bond-funded housing served intended populations. Our audit looked at the city's first five housing bond projects, totaling 593 units that are either already existing or planned. The first project, a building called the Ellington, which had 262 units, and is on Northeast 66th, already had tenants when the city purchased it soon after the housing bond was approved. In September 2017, the Housing Bureau purchased a lot with a building on it at Southeast 30th and Powell with the intent to demolish the building and develop the lot into a 160-unit building. The city purchased a new apartment building at Southeast 105th and Burnside in June 2018, which has now been leased out. That building has 51 units. In July 2018, the Bureau purchased a lot with a house on it, slated for demolition and development of a 50-unit building at Northeast 58th and Prescott. Finally, the city bought an existing 70-unit apartment building, the West Wend, in Old Town, which serves a very low-income population. It's in poor condition, and the Bureau plans to replace it with the same size building serving the same population. Leading up to the election, the city told voters that the housing bond, which was to be repaid from property taxes, would house families, seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities. The bond was meant to fund 1,300 housing units over 5 to 8 years, serving households making no more than 60% of the median income for the region, and in some cases, no more than 30% of median income. Half of the 1,300 units would be family-sized, meaning 2 bedrooms or more, and if non-bond funds are available, 300 of the very low-income units will be designated as supportive housing units, which means they include help for tenants with complex needs. When the bond passed in 2016, state law said that only a public entity could own bond-funded properties. Typically, the Housing Bureau acts as a lender rather than an owner, and that meant they'd be taking on a new role. The Bureau turned to Multnomah County's Housing Authority, Home Forward, for help with its new ownership role. Overall, our audit found the housing bond to be off to a solid start. First, we found the Housing Bureau developed project selection criteria that were mostly in line with promises to voters. The criteria were developed over several months by a group convened by the Bureau after the purchase of the Ellington, which prompted some housing stakeholders to argue for an overall strategy before additional bond purchases were made. City Council adopted the criteria in October 2017, around the same time that the second housing bond purchase was adopted. That criteria, known as the policy framework, when compared to the ballot language, introduced new areas of focus and de-emphasized or eliminated some topics. Veterans, although included in the ballot language, were not included in the policy framework. And seniors and people with disabilities, although included in the framework, weren't emphasized as much as might have been expected based on their prominence in the ballot language. Our second audit finding was that the Housing Bureau appeared to apply project selection criteria consistently when choosing which bond projects to pursue.
I'm sorry, consistently?
Consistently.
Do me a favor, move the mic just a little closer.
Oh, sure, yeah, it is a little off.
Well, the acoustics in this building are also
yeah,
hard.
Sorry. We were able to piece together an understanding of the rationale behind each bond purchase using various sources, but couldn't find a concise record explaining why each property was purchased and how each decision advanced the goals of the bond. More transparency would have been helpful, and the first annual report on the bond was only completed recently. Each project was justifiable in helping to further bond goals, although it's too soon to say if the overall effect will be that all bond goals will be met. Finally, we found the Housing Bureau, working with Home Forward, developed a targeted approach for getting tenants into bond units. Data on the 2 housing bond projects that have tenants show that bond projects are serving diverse populations. Voters approved a change to the state constitution in fall 2018, allowing the city to loan bond proceeds for affordable housing to private entities rather than owning all the bond projects themselves. That change will upend how tenants are placed in bond properties. Instead of overseeing leasing activities directly or through Home Forward, the Bureau is shifting gears and setting expectations for developers and property owners about how to find tenants from the priority communities included in the policy framework. We made 3 recommendations in this audit. The recommendations focused on the Housing Bureau better meeting voter expectations for future bond projects, improving documentation and communication about the rationale behind future bond projects, and evaluating how successful future bond property owners are at reaching target populations. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Those are our four audit reports.
Thanks for coming in. We appreciate it. Thank you for the discussion. It was a good discussion.
Madam Auditor, you're the first auditor that Commissioner Fritz and I have served with who has made a regular habit of presenting your audits to the council as a whole and having this discussion. And that's a level of transparency that I'm not quite sure why we didn't do that before, although there were some interesting personality issues, I think, involved. But really appreciate that you've made this cornerstone of your service, that you come and present directly to the council and by extension to the public, and give us a chance to have this conversation.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleagues, Commissioner